720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. Lots to do on the show today. We're going to be talking a little bit about financial markets and some updates from Mattel about Barbie, big plans for Barbie in the works. And we're going to be taking a look at, if you recall, we were talking a couple of weeks ago on the program, we were talking about a predatory lending practice that was affecting small business owners. There are updates there. So we're going to be talking about that a bit more. But right now we're joined by Trip Mickle, who is a reporter at Wall Street Journal, who has written about Apple's proposed new campuses in Austin and Seattle, how much money is going into them, how many jobs they will create, why those cities, all these questions answered here. Trip, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
For sure. Thanks. I appreciate you taking time to talk with us. So talk us through this story for those who perhaps haven't been following it. I think a lot of conversation went around Amazon looking for other locations in other cities, and kind of suddenly Apple's right behind them looking at other cities too.
Apple announced in January, when it made an announcement related to tax reform and its plans to bring home a bunch of cash it had overseas, that it was going to look for a new campus as well, but took a very different approach from Amazon. Tim Cook earlier this year actually criticized Amazon for doing what he called a beauty contest. And Apple prefers to do things quietly and secretly, and promised by the end of the year they'd name a new campus. And that's exactly what they did this past week when they said they'd spend $1 billion for a second campus in Austin, Texas.
And so what are the numbers when we're looking at that? What are they forecasting that is going to bring to Austin?
They're forecasting that will deliver another 5,000 jobs to Austin, where they already have 6,200 employees. And then on top of Austin, they also announced that they would add about 1,000 jobs and a handful of satellite offices they already have around the country, those being Culver City, California, Seattle, and San Diego.
And is the sense that you have that each of these offices will have a very specific different focus, or are they all going to do a little bit of everything?
Absolutely. If you look at Apple's business right now, it's really wrestling with its iPhone identity. Sales of the iPhone, sales growth, and the number of iPhones that Apple sells on an annual basis have slowed, and the company is trying to shift to software and services sales and selling higher-priced gadgets. We've seen iPhone prices go up, and each of these three markets address that transition and strategy. In the case of San Diego, they have a real rich talent pool of semiconductor engineers, and Apple's increasingly developing customized chips for features like Face ID, the facial recognition system, in the latest iterations of the iPhones that have allowed those prices to increase. In the case of Seattle, they have a lot of talent in machine learning, which is critical to personalization of things like your music playlist and Apple Music. And then in the case of Culver City, California, Apple's allocated $1 billion to poach Hollywood talent and develop video programming that it plans to launch next year.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you next. I'm glad that you went there, and that was kind of what their plans are and what you've learned from reporting this about where they're looking for the future. And it does seem like all signs are pointing to that investment in video content.
Yeah, absolutely. And the video push has been fascinating to watch. Of course, we've seen high-profile agreements like the ones that signed with Oprah Winfrey, which may be of interest to your Chicago listeners, to develop some programming, in addition to agreements with Reese Witherspoon, a film studio called A24. And a lot of its approach is reminiscent of what we've already seen from Netflix and Amazon. And the question is, can Apple catch up to those two in the video programming game, even though it's coming to it late?
And then, of course, there is conversation swirling around from the Trump administration often about manufacturing jobs and shifting them into the U.S. And, so much conversation has centered around Chinese manufacturing with Apple. Is there any sense that there's any shift there, or is Apple continue to kind of push back against that rhetoric?
The shift there is in terms of what's come and emanated from President Trump himself. If you recall, on the campaign trail, he was highly critical of Apple. And immediately prior to the inauguration in early 2017, he even called on Tim Cook to build his biggest, quote-unquote, manufacturing plant in the world in the U.S. and return to the U.S. manufacturing jobs of things like the iPhone. Apple has worked hard to explain to President Trump why that's not feasible, in large part because of the supply chain for electronics being so rooted in Asia, and it's kind of pursued what it considers to be advantageous for the U.S., which is, you know, higher-end jobs, engineering jobs, and some of those types of things that they're bringing to Austin. And yesterday they got a big thumbs up from the president when he tweeted out a tweet of gratitude to Tim Cook.
What do you think has been the most surprising move from Apple? I know they tend to be so under the radar and really seem like they're very laser focused. But of all this, kind of stepping back from all the reporting you've done on Apple, which is so very extensive, what is the most surprising move that you have seen from them in this past year?
I think the most surprising thing that the investors are still wrestling with of late is their November 1st announcement that they're not going to report unit sales anymore. Unit sales are just the shipment numbers for iPhone, iPad, and the Mac. And those have really been a bedrock of understanding Apple's business going back to the 80s. Steve Jobs famously said, you know, criticized Amazon for, you know, releasing the Kindle but not saying how many Kindles it sold, and kind of pointing into that as like evidence that the Kindle wasn't all that popular, because if you were proud of something, you would tell everybody how many of them you're selling. Now Apple's kind of reversing that position itself, and it's not even going to announce those unit sales. And what that means for the company going forward is yet to be seen, but it's certainly something that's affected the stock. The company's stock is down about 25% since that November 1st announcement.
Right. Yeah, that is a good call there. That is really interesting. So we will continue to turn to you for the latest, but what are the milestones we should be looking for and upcoming news from Apple as this continues to develop in Austin and these other cities?
I think the 2019 year is really going to be, when it comes to Apple, really going to be focused on the services business and just how much they're able to continue to sell apps across the App Store, iCloud subscriptions, this Hollywood programming effort, Apple Music subscriptions. All of that is going to be so key to the company's future, but that, I think, is really something that everyone will be looking to in 2019.
Indeed. Well, Trip Mickle, reporter at Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about Mattel's big plan for Barbie. Lots of plans for Barbie, that's for sure. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're joined now by Julie Cresswell, who is a reporter at the New York Times, who wrote about Mattel's recent struggles that are linked to the struggles of a lot of toy manufacturers and Mattel's big plans for Barbie. Julie, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to us about Barbie. What's going on with, you know, we've talked a lot about toy manufacturers, in particular how the kind of the shift has happened for them since Toys R Us hit their struggles in recent years, and more people are doing their shopping online versus in stores and that kind of thing. But what specifically is going on with Barbie?
You know, there's a lot of different trends, I think, that have hit Barbie as well as other toys that are made by Mattel. Barbie being obviously the one that most people recognize, but there's also Hot Wheels. They do all the Fisher-Price toys, which if you've got a toddler, you know, they've drooled over a Fisher-Price toy or two. And then they've also own the American Girl line. And sort of overall, I think one of the big trends that all of the toy manufacturers, including Mattel, are struggling with are children giving up their sort of physical toys at earlier and earlier ages because parents, including myself, are handing them an iPad or handing them, you know, a gaming console or computer. So there's sort of that digital wave is one of the big trends. But definitely, I think the closure of the Toys R Us stores are hurting all of these manufacturers this season. As customers, I think, try to figure out where it is they are going to be doing their toy shopping.
And as you note in this piece that you wrote at NewYorkTimes.com, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'll be sure and tweet this out after the program so you can read it for yourself. But there's some data that you note about the hit that Mattel has taken is really quite significant when we're just as a, you know, take the fun toy part out of it and just look at it, the business part of it. And there's some pretty severe numbers.
The numbers hurt. Yeah, I mean, they've lost billions in sales. They've gone from having almost a billion dollar profit 5 years ago to an expected loss of $500 million this year. And their stock is trading at a 10-year low. So things are definitely not fun in Toyland for Mattel right now.
And so just a bit ago on the program, we were talking a little bit about Apple's kind of new focus a little bit and how they're redirecting towards video content. And it seems like that might be kind of what Mattel is thinking, too.
Exactly. They've got a new CEO. He came in April. And it's their fourth CEO in 5 years. So they've had a bit of a merry-go-round with CEOs. But his background is in sort of media entertainment. He led Fox Kids Europe for a while. He did another European media company. And his sort of plan is to take a lot of these brands, so take your Barbie, take your Hot Wheels, take your American Girl, and find ways to commercialize that for Mattel through videos, through movies, through video games. I mean, we can all kind of imagine, right, what a Hot Wheels video game might look like, or what a Netflix series of American Girl could look like. You know, there's a lot of opportunity there that I think he believes Mattel hasn't sort of capitalized on its brands quite enough.
And when we look at other big brands that we're thinking of in terms of children and toys, we're, you know, Disney and Hasbro, and those guys come up pretty quickly. And Hasbro seems like, certainly Disney has, but it also seems like Hasbro has done some forays into that same video space with some success as well. So it would make sense that Mattel would go there. But there's some intertwining there when we factor in this new CEO.
Right. He's, again, has this really rich background in media, and I think that it's going to be really interesting to see sort of what projects he, again, I think what they're going to be announcing is a Barbie movie, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays. You know, I mean, again, these are generally movies that are sort of more geared toward an adult audience. But they still want to sell a doll to a little girl. And it's a really careful sort of tightrope they have to walk there.
Also, who in the world is going to play Barbie? Who do you even cast? How does that start?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, again, as you mentioned, you know, they've tiptoed and they've tried to make some different movies and TV shows. And about a year and a half ago, the name that got attached to a project was Amy Schumer. And everybody inside Mattel was having a heart attack. Even though they may very much love Amy Schumer and very much love Amy Schumer movies, they were very much concerned about what an Amy Schumer-like movie could do to their ability to sell dolls to little girls. You know, the actress whose name is now coming up, the option for that particular movie that was attached to Amy Schumer's expired. And so they're now expected to be making a new announcement with a different studio, and the name that's getting attached to it now is Margot Robbie, who was nominated for an Oscar earlier this year for her role in I, Tonya. There's been interesting, you know, one of the people sort of said, you know, you could see very much sort of like the Tom Hanks, Daryl Hannah splash kind of movie out of this, you know, something where you've got sort of a doll who comes into the real world and sort of her interactions in that way. But again, I think what Mattel wants is to make sure that they're going to be able to have some oversight of the script and some oversight of the casting so that they don't do any, so that nothing happens that damages the brand itself.
Sure, sure. You know, I also can't help but wonder when, in the moment that we're in, culturally and socially, we're having a lot of conversation about gender and shifting a lot in our workplaces, in our homes, in our lives. Barbie or Mattel a few years ago had the announcement of the different body shapes of and you know body types and trying to diversify Barbie and make it more realistic and all that. And then there's always the different types. There's the chef and the CEO and the lawyer and the doctor and all these different types of Barbie. I can't help but wonder if there's not some bit of overlap there too. If maybe like the doll space of this kind of beautiful, you know, sexy, perfect body, you know, unrealistically perfect body doll is just maybe a different, we're just moving into a different space.
I think it's an interesting question. Again, I think it's been easier for Hasbro, for instance, to, I think, commercialize a lot of its properties. Transformers, you know, that's a movie that you can, you know, little boys are going to line up to see and then go buy the toys. You know, they successfully took a board game, Battleship, and made it into a movie. You know, these are action movies that are sort of very, like, ready for Hollywood. You know, you can, and then again, to have it sold to the kids and sort of market it, it's been a little easier. Although, again, Hasbro also had My Little Pony, which, you know, quite frankly, I think that goes back to the 80s. You know, they rebooted that, and it's been a very successful reboot and refranchise. I think Barbie does, again, as you point out, has very much that struggle between what we want our girls to sort of, how we want them to see themselves and how we want them to see their own bodies. And, again, while creating these dolls and selling these dolls, I think it is very challenging. And they, again, I think they're trying to kind of keep the playbook that's worked for them. Barbie is actually, again, with all of Mattel's woes, Barbie is actually one of the stronger or more stable properties. American Girl, for instance, has just fallen completely off the cliff. And then there was another doll line called Monster High, which was huge about 3 or 4 years ago. That's also just disappeared. So Barbie does remain, you know, a mainstay. But I think, yeah, it's a huge challenge for this company to understand in today's world how to evolve Barbie and how to, you know, keep her up to date with how parents want their children to interact and see themselves.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we will keep turning to you for the latest. Julie Creswell, reporter at New York Times, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots to do here on the second half of the show. We're joined now by Justin Doperal, who is the president of Domo Capital. You know, anytime we are taking a look at financial markets, I'm like, I am no expert, so let's call one. So that's always my thought. Justin, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
For sure. I appreciate you making the time to talk with us on a Saturday. So to start, tell us a bit about Domo Capital, if you would.
Yeah, so we're an asset manager, and we manage a single portfolio for individuals and institutions through separately managed accounts. And our five-year performance through the last quarter of almost 22% a year after fees was recently ranked number one for U.S. equity in Morningstar's database. And since our inception in 2008, we've returned over 18.5% a year after fees.
And so we hear a lot about, you know, there's so much information out there about our financial lives, about all kinds of things, right? But, and it can be a bit overwhelming. But I think a narrative we hear again and again is about, you know, diversify your portfolio. That'll protect you in volatile times. And as we are having some rather volatile times in the market, I think that, you know, of course, lots of financial professionals are saying that and diversify everything to protect yourself from this kind of thing. But you have perhaps a different theory and a different approach there. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, so there's really three main ways that we sort of manage the market's volatility. So first, we buy stocks of quality companies at valuations that are significantly below their historical averages. We find that these opportunities typically arise due to the market's tendency to overreact to events that have happened most recently. Second, we use cash as a strategic asset. So, like, heading into the Brexit vote a couple of years back, we actually had a 90% cash position that shielded our clients when the markets fell over 5% the following couple of days. And then third and most importantly, we believe that having a concentrated portfolio of less than 20 stocks that represents only our very best ideas is essential to outperforming the market in the long run. And if, you know, if we can't find any good ideas, we'll hold cash. We're not going to force an okay or an average idea. And, you know, we believe that's the best way to outperform the benchmarks and create great returns and mitigate risk to the downside. You know, I think more specifically, you know, when we're talking about other portfolio managers and, you know, if you look at other funds, they're probably holding hundreds and hundreds of stocks. And I guess our belief is that over-diversification is what makes it difficult to outperform the market, because it's unlikely that the portfolio manager holding all those hundreds of stocks thinks that they're better than maybe his top 20 ideas. But there's probably less capital allocated to those top 20 ideas compared to the total capital allocated to the remaining hundreds of stocks. And that just doesn't make sense to us. And we believe that adding inferior ideas to the portfolio simply for diversification actually adds risk rather than reducing it.
So if we break that all down into non-financial language, I think what I'm hearing you say, though, is rather than have dozens of stocks in your portfolio that you feel perhaps kind of lukewarm or meh about, better to have a fewer number that you feel very strongly about.
Absolutely. And if you can't find those stocks that you think are really good ideas, then that's probably a great barometer that maybe the overall market is overpriced and you know, you're just better off holding more cash.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to me that in financial conversations, we tend to, you know, it's just numbers, it's just data, and that part seems pretty straightforward. But yet, we hear often, don't make emotional decisions, you know, don't get scared and pull your money out of something, things like that. And yet, there is a lot of kind of emotional and very human language around it, like having stocks you feel strongly about versus ones you don't really have too strong opinion about. And you know, it's just interesting to me that there is a lot of like gut checking and a lot of kind of personal preference in something that is data driven. It's really just a numbers game.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one way to kind of take advantage of, you know, the market's emotions and how it reacts to certain things is, you know, one of the major things we do is just, you know, rebalancing within the portfolio. So even just during the most recent sell-off in this last few months here, you know, while we've certainly had stocks that have underperformed the market, you know, we've had others that have actually outperformed the market and even had gains. So what we've been able to do is kind of reduce those positions and then take that money and add it to our positions that have performed much more poorly. And then, you know, when the market turns around, that's really going to drive returns and it's going to help reduce risk.
So if people listening have questions, where can they contact you or others at Domo Capital?
Yeah, the best place is just check out our website, www.domocapital.com, and we'd be happy to get in touch with you.
Sounds great. Justin Doparala, thanks so much for joining us today on the program.
Great. Thanks a lot for having me.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to be following up on a story we talked about a couple of weeks ago about a predatory lending practice. There's more information there. So we're going to be talking about that here in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for spending time with us today. If you will recall, a couple of weeks ago on the program, we talked with Zachary Miter, a reporter at Bloomberg, who has been working on a series about predatory lending practices that have impacted small businesses, and really a very horrifying story. Well, as I said, that is a series and there are updates. There's more to discuss. So please welcome back to the program, Zachary Miter. Welcome back. Thanks for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here, Amy.
So tell us, what is the latest, but for perhaps for those who don't remember, maybe refresh our memories a little bit about the story you had originally discussed on the program.
Sure. So we wrote a story that kind of shows how the New York State has kind of played this weird role where it's kind of given rise to this whole industry of predatory lenders that prey on small businesses across the country. And they use some quirks of New York state law that allow the lenders to go after borrowers who they claim to be delinquent and actually seize their bank accounts before the borrowers even know that there's a problem. And, you know, we reported that there are plenty of cases of allegations of abuse and fraud where, you know, people aren't really delinquent, but they're having these their bank accounts seized by lenders, or their lenders are exaggerating how much money they're allowed to take. And we found that this technique was used about 25,000 times in New York, mostly just in the past 2 years.
Which is really so stunning. And I have to say, after the program, I tweeted that story out and kind of kept an eye on that for a couple of days. And it was really interesting. I thought the conversations on social media around it seemed like that was so eye-opening to so many people, because you just don't think that kind of thing is possible.
Yeah, that was the reaction we got from a lot of readers and also elected officials was, you know, if I didn't read it, I wouldn't believe such a thing could be possible in America, where we think of our justice system as being pretty great.
Right, right. We think, in particular, it was the part that in that original story about how a lender could do all of this without you even knowing, and then suddenly your assets are seized. That would be so devastating, as you pointed out in the story, and the family that you profiled that had lost so much. And so, what has been the reaction since then, and what new things have come from this?
Right. So there's actually been a lot of reaction from public officials. On the federal level, a couple of senators, one Republican, one Democrat, have actually already proposed legislation to ban this technique called confession of judgment nationwide for commercial contracts. And obviously that hasn't become law, and it won't in this session of Congress, but it shows that people are paying attention in Congress. And then on the state level, the New York Attorney General has opened an investigation and sent a subpoena to the company that has filed the most confessions of judgment. It's responsible for about 25% of the total. And then state lawmakers in both chambers in New York are talking about a number of different reforms. And then on the local level in New York City, the city marshals actually play this crucial role in nationwide collections for these lenders. They can seize money from banks, people's bank accounts all over the country. And the mayor has said he's looking into this and has put the reappointment of one of these marshals on hold.
Which is so fascinating, you know, and to me that really just speaks to the power of good journalism like this, that you are able to, you know, show the facts, let them speak for themselves, and action comes from them, and laws are changed. And that's so powerful and so wonderful. And I'm so glad to hear that's been the result. And I'm sure many small business owners are as well. What is the timeline on these pieces of proposed legislation?
Well, that's what's interesting is that, you know, obviously a lot of public officials paying attention, talking about doing things, but we're watching the court dockets every day, and it's business as usual. I mean, you know, the pace of, we reported the pace of filings against businesses all over the country was about 1,200 a month this fall. It doesn't look like it's slowed down at all. So even though there's talk of change, none of it has actually turned into reality yet. And it's likely that it won't for at least some period of time. I think it depends on, you know, really it's in lawmakers' hands on the federal and state level to, you know, decide what the solution is. They could try to do something very narrow or something very broad, and that would probably change the timeline quite a bit.
It is really, again, it's such a fascinating and horrifying practice that you wouldn't even imagine exists. And so do you have any sense of perhaps some of these companies that are doing this, are there going to be any perhaps defensive maneuvers or something like that to protect themselves or perhaps escape prosecution or something like that as these conversations continue to evolve?
Well, I'm sure they will. I mean, these are companies that you know, already have trade groups and lobbyists, and I'm sure those efforts will be, they'll have extra, you know, they'll be extra busy next year trying to fend off some of these reforms. But what's interesting is that one of the main trade groups that represents alternative small business lenders, including merchant cash advance, has actually come out in favor of the ban on confessions of judgment. So they're saying basically that's an ugly part of our industry that we don't want to be a part of, and so we support it. There's another trade group that hasn't come out against it. So, but even within the industry, one of the things that's been interesting to me is how many people in the cash advance industry say, you know, this is a long time coming. We need, we want a level playing field so that people who bend the rules or are aggressive don't have an advantage over lenders who are trying to do the right thing.
That's really interesting, and that's very powerful that one of the groups themselves is in favor of it. I think that's very reassuring. So for those listening, what kind of things can small business owners be doing to protect themselves?
I think the main one is that these lenders, you know, they solve a problem for a lot of small businesses, which is they need cash very quickly. Oftentimes they either don't qualify for a bank loan or just the paperwork and time and wait is too long. They need money like this week. And I think they need to know that there are some lenders who have a pretty good reputation who can provide those kind of services. And there are other ones that they really need to be careful of. And especially when they're signing documents that essentially give up their rights to defend themselves in court if they're later accused of defaulting. So even though they intend to pay the loan back and are paying the loan back, they can essentially be unilaterally told they're not paying it back and face all these enormous penalties and have their bank accounts frozen. That's the kind of decision that they need to be really have their eyes open before they sign a document like that. It's called a confession of judgment.
Right. Indeed. Well, for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to be sure and share a lot, all of these stories in this series, because it's so fascinating and it's really such important work that you're doing. So thank you so much for joining us on the program again to talk this through and give us updates. Please come back with more updates anytime. Zachary Miner, reporter at Bloomberg.
Thank you, Amy.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, that does it for me here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. And we welcome our friend Scott Catoon into the studio. But, you know, Scott, today we ran out of time. But we were going to talk about giving DNA kits for holiday gifts.
Yeah.
What is your opinion on that?
Am I giving my DNA? Like, do I have
to? Like, if you got a gift, if I was like, here, Scott, I got you a gift. It's a DNA ancestry kit. Like, what would you think? Would you be like,
I give it to my wife.
But you wouldn't take it?
No.
See, so that...
I don't know if I'm... Like, not for any reason. I just, I'm not...
Yeah, there's a lot of considerations. I think... I would feel weird about giving a gift unless someone specifically said, I would love to take this, you know.
WGN gave chocolate, nuts, and wine.
That's right.
Let's stick with that.
Let's stick with the things
I can eat.
There are surprises in there, right? Like a friend of mine, and she's talked about this widely, so she wouldn't mind me saying this. She took a DNA test recently,
yep.
And then later mentioned it to her parents, and they were like,
Oh, geez.
Turns out she got connected with a sister she didn't know she had. Her dad kind of knew, maybe thought,
yeah, I bet he
maybe
did.
That was a thing.
I bet that was a real quiet night at the house.
You know what? They're all good friends now. It's all good. But yeah, I mean, sometimes skeletons can come out of closets when you do that.
I think, you know what? I don't know. I have nothing to hide. And I think the technology is super cool.
It's interesting.
But I just am a little, I feel like I just told my wife this morning, I want to take all of our Alexas and throw them in the garbage because they like pick up, they're listening to everything.
Yeah.
And now I'm just getting to a point where I'm like, I
have many times, a lot of times on the air, I'll be ranting and I'll say, seriously, in such a...
And the phone, yeah.
And Siri comes on and I'm yes. like, so I'm with you on that.
Yeah, I'm not digging the every part of our life invasiveness.
2019, let's dial it down with the data a little bit.
Yeah, I just, again, another 2 points to the wife. She pointed out this morning that the gig economy is like supposed to be all the rage again. And I mean, they've said this every year, but like...
Yeah. Nah.
No? Where are you at on that?
I think it's making people tired.
You're like
tired.
The queen of gig economy.
I am gig economy.
You are the definition of gig economy.
I haven't had a vacation in 7 years because all of my jobs haven't lined up. So, yeah, no, I'm not feeling it on the gig economy.
So it's the non-gig economy for 19.
Yeah, I'm trying to dial it down a little bit.
I think you might have just identified one of the biggest like failures of that system that hasn't really been spoken about. Because I think, if you think about gig economy, people are like, oh, it's great.
You can
like,
work you've when got, you want. You, no, you
no,
have to.
No, you never stop working. That's
right.
Actually what happens.
Yeah.
You're just on lots of hamster wheels at the same time. It's exhausting.
I'm getting stressed out thinking. Maybe it's because I've had six cups of coffee, but
yeah, well,
somewhere in the middle.
I better turn it over to you because I got to go do my other jobs.
That is ironic. Like
that is the most 2018 thing I've ever seen.
That is bye-bye 2018.
What are you doing on the show today?
We've got Jason Camosa. He's a good buddy of mine. He works for a company called AdQuick, which is the co-founder of Reddit, is a big investor in that. Yeah. And he actually liked and commented on my post, the Alexis O'Hanahan, or however you pronounce it, from Reddit. He commented on one of my posts, and so I just totally nerded out.
Ooh, you fancy.
I know, very fancy. So Jason's going to spend the whole time with us, and then we'll have two companies call in. And he's an angel investor in some companies, too, so we'll maybe invest in some companies.
Great.
It should be fun. Have like fun. Every show. Why do I say should? It's going to be fun.
Yeah, I know. You're always like hopeful. Like it's going to be fine.
I hit the button and then I'm like, I'm not sure what's going to happen.